This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 280, was recorded on July 15th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. Variant Perception market strategist Aaron Param joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss whether inflation is secular or transitory, stocks, U.S. dollar, emerging markets, China, bond yields, commodities, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick's chart deck is titled Sectors, Breadth, and the Gold Option Skew. In the interest of transparency, due to international travel, quarantine, lockdown, and coping with having my luggage stolen, I'm not as on top of the markets as usual this week and will be relying on Patrick for some support in the market wrap.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's start with that S&P 500. Been kind of tapping toward that 4,400 level, a little bit of selling here. What's your take on all the price action here?
You know, Patrick, the last few days I've been out of touch with my charts. Some equipment got stolen and I couldn't get things. And I'm reading Zero Hedge and futures down on declining bond yields. And I'm thinking, is it below the 50-day moving average yet? Is it really big? I finally got the charts working today. It's like, what are they upset about? It's because there hasn't been a fresh new all-time high in the stock market for like almost 48 hours now. Is that the problem? So I don't get why anybody doesn't see this as anything other than just a continuing melt-up is the way I see it. What's going on here, Patrick?
Well, you know, we are in the option expiration week. And like when we have Charlie McElligott on the show, we talk about all of the influences of the delta and gamma pins that occur during these OPEX periods. There is substantial gamma up in this 4350 to 4400 level on the S&P, which was a pretty key overhead resistance. And that has contained almost all of the overhead highs into this tail end of the week. But that all rolls off this weekend. And so usually when we have that gamma pin removed, it does usher in volatility. And I want to say with volatility, it doesn't necessarily mean downside volatility, but it's simply that the markets become more on an intraday basis volatile, both higher and lower. It'll be really interesting to see whether we are met with just a very quick dip on the downside and whether that turns into buying. The interesting part is a number of these markets are getting heavy. I want to talk about it in our post game where we talk about how the breadth of the market just has not been picking up. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens when the market gets checked on this rally at some point, a quick 5% drop at some point. We're long overdue for that.
Patrick, I couldn't agree more. And I want to ask Aaron Param about this breadth issue in today's feature interview.
Right. So anyway, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, which we're trading around 92.65 at the time of recording. Any insights on the dollar here for you?
Well, just looking at the chart, it seems like this rally is starting to run out of steam, but it hasn't reversed lower yet. To my eye, we need a new high, to get a series of higher highs and higher lows. We need to have a higher high over 93.5 on a closing basis. We're a long way from that. So I see it as just a continuation of the consolidation, and I think that this U.S. dollar index market is really looking for direction because nobody can really sort out such a complex picture. You have to evaluate not just U.S. monetary policy, but European and other central bank monetary policies to try to figure out what's happening. And these things are so political and in such a big state of flux, I don't think anybody knows.
Right. I mean, when I look at that dollar index, it is approaching a lot of key overhead resistance. When you go to some of the individual components like the Euro-US cross, that 117 support is right there. And it's a level where the market should find some support. So while the dollar, US dollar trend is up now for the last month, we have some very key levels that are going to at least act as a resistance point. So expecting some consolidation dollar along these key levels is expected. Anyway, let's move on to crude oil, which did not make a higher high and is off a few dollars. We're down close to $72 right now after being as high as 77 last week. What's your take on crude here?
You know, it's really fascinating, Patrick, because last week, if you remember, the narrative in the marketplace was OPEC was unable to reach a deal on increasing production. And what that means is OPEC is about to, you know, completely fail and crumble and collapse. And that's going to mean that there's a free-for-all and prices are going to crash because everybody's producing too much. So last week, the logic was if OPEC is unable to make a deal, that means price should go down. This week, the logic is if OPEC is able to make a deal and is able to increase production, that means price should go down. So it seems like everybody is kind of gotten to the point where they're just, you know, so much, so fast, getting all the way back up over $75 so quickly, a number that a lot of people thought was impossible this year. I think we're still headed for $80 to $92. I think we'll get there before Labor Day. But at the same time, it seems like right now we're in some kind of correction or consolidation before we move higher. I really don't see this going a whole lot lower, though. We've already hit the 34-day moving average today. We could still take a dip down to the 55-day moving average. That would be a target down around 68, spot 98. So call it $69 would be, that's the 55 has been what's caught the market on each of the serious corrections that we've had in this rally since November. So if it was going to go down more than this, I wouldn't expect it to go down much more than that. But I think by Labor Day, we're going to be looking at 80 plus.
Eric, I see the oil market very similarly to you. Using sort of like the analog of the March market correction in crude, when it failed to make a higher high in early March, it ushered in about a one-month correction that saw back then close to a $10 drop. It wasn't quite that much, but a consolidation off the highs and just absorbed that previous advance. But that became simply a buying opportunity for another move. I think that's going to be the real tell is that if crude oil makes it down to that 70 or 69 level, will the typical buy on dip traders that have been here for what it seems almost a year, well, at least since November, will they reemerge and buy the dip on crude? And that's going to be one of the more interesting things to watch. How did the inventory numbers come in?
Well, Patrick, I think this market is going to be all about inventory for the next month, because going back to what you said a minute ago, you know, are we headed much lower or are we going to have reality set back in as to the tightness that I think really exists in this market? It's going to be whether or not we get the series of, let's say, 5 to 8 million barrel or more weekly drawdowns on inventory. Now, we got another one this week. It's kind of funny. EIA inventory was delayed. First time I've ever seen this. Not a scheduled announced delay like they do on holidays, but basically they just screwed up and they were about an hour late getting their data out this week. At least that's as far as I can tell what happened. I don't have the numbers in front of me because of my logistics situation this week. It was about an 8 million barrel drawdown, so another big draw on inventory, but it wasn't enough to really push the market back up. And I think that's because everybody's saying, look, OPEC's about to make a deal and flood the market with a whole bunch of new oil. I think OPEC probably is about to make a deal, but I don't think they're going to flood the market with a whole bunch of new oil. And I think we're going to need a lot. So some analysts are saying there could be like 50 million barrels plus of inventory drawdowns in the month of August alone. If that really happens, I think things are going to be pretty stretched. But let's keep an eye on the needle in coming weeks.
All right, let's touch on gold here. What's your take?
Well, you know, everybody seems to be getting excited about this. I want to be excited too. But if I look at the chart, Patrick, where we are is right at key resistances. And the market seems to at least be stalling, at least in the last day or so. That key resistance is right around 1840. And it's the confluence of the 34, 55, and 200-day simple moving averages. And, you know, we got to get through those numbers and close above them and stay above them. So I think the number to close on, I think right now, is around 1843. I don't have the chart in front of me to know for sure. Approximately that number. Let's say 1845 to be safe. We get to 1845 and stay above 1845, and I get a whole lot more bullish. Right now, we're at the key resistance level. If it's going to reverse and move lower, this is the place it ought to happen. So let's see what happens.
You know, I have to agree with you on that level, but I actually look at it from a Fibonacci perspective, which also lines up with your moving averages, right around this 1835 level is a 50% retracement of the drop. And so when we were so oversold on the gold drop, it is very typical to see that mean reverting kind of bounce. And we're coming right to a critical level. I mean, if this is a bounce, and if it was only a bounce from an oversold state and the downtrend continues, this is a level where it would likely reject. And so what I'm looking for, I want to be bullish gold. And so what I'm really looking for is some real follow through that that signifies that the bulls have regained control of this trend, and that will take a break of these levels. And so it's interesting that you came up with the same kind of price levels with the moving averages as I did with Fibs, but it's definitely a very critical level on gold. Anyway, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yield. What's your take on it here?
Well, we're sitting, at least this morning, where we're sitting right on 1.34. Now, that is a critical number. Back in 2016, when I think Jeff Gundlach declared that's the forever low yield, that was a really key technical level at that point. And, of course, that we did eventually break lower, much lower. And now the question would be, since we managed on this latest move to get up to 1.75, is 1.34 going to be a key support level, or can we move back down below 1%? I think that's a really, really good question. I certainly don't know the answer, but I'll be watching carefully. I think 1.34 would be, to my eye, a very logical support level, and it, for now, seems to be holding. What's your take, Patrick?
Well, you know what? What I find really interesting is, once again, we get some very high inflation prints, both on CPI and PPI. That's 3 months in a row. And the bond market seems to be brushing it right off, and the bond rally continues, and yields are pressing lower, and something's got to give. And it's really interesting that no sooner did those numbers come out that the 10-year yields are pressing right back down. I mean, we're at 1.30 right now. You know what? Right now, it seems like the bulls have some sort of momentum behind them, and I don't know if I want to stand in the way of this. I want to first see what happens here. I don't want to get bullish bonds outright, but they certainly are driving yields lower here, and it'll be interesting to see whether they can punch to a lower low into next week. Nonetheless, this week's featured interview guest is Aaron Param from Variant Perception. Now, Eric, why did we invite the Variant Perception team back this week?
Well, we wanted to get Variant Perception back because they're a data-driven macro shop. They've really given us some great interviews in the past. Aaron is one of their key market strategists, and he's one of the few guys, senior guys on the team there that we've never had on the show before. So we wanted to change things up a little bit, and I think you'll find a fascinating interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Aaron is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abex also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Michelle Dennity's five-part series about the role of digital innovation in advancing the ESG economy is live now at smartermarketspod.com, and you can look for another terrific interview every Saturday morning. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app in order to listen to this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Aaron Param, investment strategist for Variant Perception. Aaron, great to get you on the program. Let's start with the big debate in finance, inflation. Some of us say it's secular. Of course, Janet says it's transitory. What is it?
Yeah, thank you, Eric. Thank you for having me on. I guess, firstly, it's just worth saying you guys have done a great job getting some very excellent views on both sides of the inflation debate from previous guests on the show. In a nutshell, our view is that inflation risks are higher than they have been in recent decades and are largely reminiscent of a late 1960s, early 1970s US economy. Now, that doesn't mean that we're guaranteed to get a secular rise of inflation, but the odds of a regime shift to a world of unanchored inflation expectations and upside inflation volatility are higher today. In terms of structural risks, I think these are quite well known. We've got the fusion of fiscal and monetary policy working hand in hand. That adds weight to the whole debasement of the currency and unanchored inflation argument. With respect to cyclical risks, I think broadly we can sum this up in the sense that we've got pent-up demands being unleashed onto an economy with persistent supply-side disruptions. And one area that we've been writing quite thoroughly about this year is housing. So if we were to just break down CPI into its various components, shelter CPI is about 30% of headline CPI and about 40% of core inflation. This series hasn't really been volatile to the upside before, but we're starting to see evidence that that's going to change pretty soon. We know that house prices in the States lead shelter CPI by about 18 months, and more specifically, that's owner's equivalent rent. So with red-hot housing data through the pandemic, we're now starting to see owner's equivalent rents track higher. And yesterday's data was really confirmation of that, of this starting to happen. The CDC eviction moratorium expired at the end of June, and that allows landlords to boot out tenants essentially and demand higher rents from new ones. And we've seen asking rents from landlords surge higher recently at the same time as vacancy rates are still very, very low. So to us, it's actually very, very strange that we're seeing such a huge divergence between what's actually reflected in CPI versus reality. And to us, that really brings into question, what's actually real? And that is a critical component for judging inflation expectations. So, you know, we can look at things like shadow stats, for instance. These things tell us that the actual inflation felt by households, it's probably a lot higher than what CPI is actually telling us. And we can also go through company transcripts. We see that their costs are rising all over the shop. And they don't think it's transitory. And now they're starting to feel the pressure to really pass this on to consumers. And so really what we're left with is that inflation expectations are the measure to watch right now. And that is really the propagation mechanism for turning cyclical or quote unquote transitory bursts in inflation into a more persistent one. And of course, there are a lot of measures of inflation expectations, whether it's from market break-evens, household surveys, professional forecaster surveys. The Fed has tried to aggregate all of these different measures into one indicator, the Common Inflation Expectations Index. That's not actually useful for investors because it's a quarterly index, firstly, and secondly, it's released with a massive lag. So we tried to build one that's pretty similar and much more timely. And this indicator has been surging from its pandemic lows. And in level terms, it's probably back to 2013 levels, which, of course, is an environment with much higher yields. I will say that it's still important to respect the broader deflationary arguments, technological change, debt dynamics, demographics, and so forth. But these structural arguments are quite hard to see in the data. And it's certainly possible that inflation and inflation expectations can spiral out of control with the backdrop of some of these structural headwinds. In terms of cyclical deflationary indicators, one thing that we're watching quite closely is bank loan growth versus bank asset growth. And this has really summed up the QE era where money growth was surging, but there wasn't really any loan demand to mop this up. And the way the credit cycle works in the data is that supply tends to lead demand. So banks usually step up lending efforts if they expect there to be sufficient demand on the other end. And what we're seeing now is that bank lending surveys, they're showing a sharp easing of credit standards alongside lowering credit spreads. So we do expect loan demand to pick up. So some of these deflationary, disinflationary indicators are starting to reverse now. But I think, you know, just the final point really to make is more of a thought exercise. You know, I loved reading Stephen Roach's piece recently on the ghost of Arthur Burns, where he gives an inside view of the Fed's thinking during the 1970s. And really what was striking to me was that there was a massively dismissive tone to inflation in the 1970s, where the Fed was essentially chalking down high inflation prints to noise and transitory factors. So there are certainly some eerie parallels to today. But I think generally it's a great exercise just to invert the problem and ask, you know, what if what we're seeing today isn't transitory? And what if we keep seeing these temporary disruptions that cause bursts of inflation? And what if this is the moment where inflation expectations finally react and they become reflexive and unanchored? So I think that's broadly how we're thinking about inflation. And I think that's it's important to invert the problem always and think about the other side of things.
Let's take this view, Aaron, and extend it to the stock market. Because on one hand, I know from talking to some of your colleagues at Variant Perception, you guys have shared some of my concerns about high valuations. But at the same time, this inflationary outlook kind of says we could go to higher valuations. What do we make here, and what sectors do we invest in if we're still in the equity market?
Yeah, I would say broadly, something that's resonated with a lot of people that we've been talking to is that we should try to think of a bull market in three different phases. And we're essentially in phase two right now. Phase one is where, quote unquote, the easy gains occur. And this is really where some of the great investors are able to buy at cheap prices, look through all the hatred and disgust. I would say that, you know, phase two, generally what we see is that trading conditions become choppier. The recovery and growth is largely priced in. Markets are in show me mode, where earnings growth has to justify the previous surge in valuations. And it's in this environment where you start to see a lot of companies disappointing. And so naturally, I think in this environment, we need to start thinking more about stock selection, more about sector country rotation, because this becomes more valuable as the index itself starts to trade more sideways. And phase three is essentially where the economic cycle starts to mature. Equity gains are driven by persistent earnings growth. And so really the difficulty today, and I think it's quite a unique difficulty, is that we've rapidly transitioned from phase one to two. And just one way to see this is by looking at analyst estimates of company earnings. You know, never before have we seen analysts revise up forward earnings estimates this quickly after recession. So the key conundrum for equity investors is that we've got an early cycle economy with late cycle asset valuations. So really, I think any forecast model that uses valuations as an input, for instance, these are just going to look awful across the board. And I think it is worth paying a bit of credence to some of these forecasts, because the track record for a lot of them are very good. Forecasts based on Shiller PEs, forecasts based on household allocation to equities. But the trouble is they're very long-term by nature, and it's quite difficult to translate that into an investment decision today. So I think the argument is there to break it down a bit further, to look at various sectors and industries. And I think the roadmap still is to favor the cyclical tilts in portfolios, because something that we know about recessions is that they mark regime shifts, both in economies and markets. And with a recession, we typically see a multi-year outperformance of cyclical assets. We see past losers become past winners. But again, it's just incredible that so many of these cyclical assets have seen forecast earnings go well in excess of 2019 levels. And 2019 was a late cycle economy. So the economic boom is priced in for a lot of the universe. I would say that the standout exceptions are very much energy and banks. We do a lot of capital cycle analysis. So we look at variables like CapEx as a percentage of asset base, the rate of asset base depletion, and various corporate return measures, and the energy sector, and in particular, explorers and producers, have seen a massive collapse in CapEx at the same time as the return on incremental investment is going up. And that's a great setup for shareholders, because you've got this consolidation of the sector, and supply rationalization means that the surviving firms can at least enjoy a period of less competition. And that's good for the share price. And, you know, right now we know that no one wants to invest in a sector that has destroyed capital for so long, particularly as we've got on the side this sexy clean energy space that's sucking in so much capital. And the Dallas Fed Energy Survey, for instance, they've got some really great quotes on oil and gas companies. And it just gives us a sense of how executives are thinking about the road ahead. So one firm, for instance, they said they've got relationships with about 400 institutional investors, and just one of them is willing to allocate new capital to oil and gas investment. But of course, we need to acknowledge that the sector itself has rallied quite massively off March 2020 lows. So starting valuations aren't as attractive as they once were. But again, in phase two of the market, I think we do need to step up that that focus on quality of management and quality of earnings. So we're not quite at the finish line for the cyclical trades, but it's now worth thinking about where to tilt with respect to equity allocations.
Now, one of the things that you said there was that country rotation would come into this, obviously implying emerging markets. I want to come back to that. Let's start with the U.S. dollar index, though. What do you make of this this dollar? It seems like everybody's confused about which way it's headed next.
Yeah, I would say that's a good way to sum it up, and that I think it's very easy to look silly when forecasting dollar returns, but at least from our indicator standpoint, something that we're seeing in the data is that there is a dollar smile evident in the data. And this is really based on Stephen Jen's framework, who was an FX strategist at Morgan Stanley. And he posited that the dollar generally has a convex relationship to US economic performance. So the dollar is generally strong during risk-off periods in times of economic stress. But it's also strong when the US economy outperforms the rest of the world. But other currencies tend to strengthen relative to the dollar when the US economy is middling. And I guess from the investor standpoint, there are higher returns to be achieved elsewhere. And we can plot just US ISM versus rest of the world PMIs, and that actually has a nice lead on the dollar. It's not a perfect relationship, but it captures some of the key turning points. And given that our growth indicators right now are incredibly strong in the States, much stronger than anywhere else, certainly in DM, we think we're moving to the right-hand side of this dollar smile. And this is an environment where the US economy, it can suck in capital inflows, investors start to pile into dollar-denominated assets, and the US economy outperforms the rest of the world. Another, I guess, technical signal that we're looking at, something to essentially check if this rally has legs, is looking at dollar breadth charts. And initially, we've found signs that this recent rally does have legs. One way we can look at this is just creating a cumulative advanced decline line for various DM currencies against the dollar, much in the same way that you can do for equity indices. And so interestingly, at the start of the year, when we had the dollar rally, it wasn't confirmed by breadth data, but today it is. So whilst we still have a lot of focus on some of the short dollar arguments, which still carry a lot of weight, things like the incredible twin deficits in the States, the greater debasement of the dollar versus other currencies, alongside a backdrop of booming global trade, there is room for a cyclical counter-consensus rally in the dollar, particularly as people start to continue covering their extreme short positions.
Let's go ahead and move into emerging markets then. Where are the plays if we're going to start trading out of developed and into emerging markets?
Yeah, so I would say that broadly we favor the resource-heavy EM sectors right now. I mean, the EM index itself is incredibly concentrated right now, being mostly allocated to China, South Korea, and Taiwan. One way that we're looking at this is essentially wrapping up our growth leading indicators for individual EMs with valuations and also with some technical signals. And what we essentially do is that we look at how many of these individual EM forecasts are positive or negative, and this works over a 6-month horizon. And right now, it's the aggregate diffusion indicator is very high, and that's broadly good actually for the MSCI EM index. But as I said before, in this kind of phase two of the bull market, it makes sense to start to think about rotating within equity indices. And I would say that right now, just on a crowded metric, things like analyst ratings, things like long-term RSIs, institutional ownership of stocks within each EM, a lot of LATAM looks incredibly undervalued, particularly as they've lagged the commodities rally. And we know that there's a ton of political stress in a lot of these economies. And typically, if you take a longer standpoint, these are typically the best times to buy. And so we're starting to think that whilst the commodities rally may be running out of wind in terms of on a cyclical basis, some of these LATAM stocks are showing a potential for a catch-up trade there.
Aram, let's talk about China specifically. You know, so much so much angst in some places, and other people see it as opportunity. How do you interpret the China situation?
Yeah, I think this is important for EM investing, especially because, I mean, China is the commodity consumer of the world. It is so important for the global growth and global liquidity argument. I would say the first thing that's worth addressing is that we're seeing a lot of charts flying around now with China's negative credit impulse being a reason to exit cyclicals and commodities. I would say there's a bit more nuance to this because it is true that Chinese domestic data is slowing down and policy is a bit more neutral versus the rest of DM, especially after the 50 bips reserve ratio cut, which we interpret as more of a technical adjustment rather than the start of a full easing cycle. But what I would say is that what's perhaps missing from the mainstream argument is that external inputs into the Chinese economy are extremely positive, and we think that this is more than offsetting domestic weakness. So our China leading indicator is actually very resilient right now because of external inputs like global manufacturing data, global trade data. And this really allows Chinese policymakers to pursue more structural issues like deleveraging for as long as the rest of the world keeps stimulating and propping up Chinese growth. Now, of course, this won't last forever, and it's probably a story for next year in terms of how China reacts to a fading external impulse. But I would say for the time being, the reflation trade is not over, and I think there is value in, again, rotating at the margin where necessary. But certainly for now, Chinese leading data is holding up.
Let's move on to bond yields. You know, we had, I guess, it seems to me like a scare after the Biden administration announced how much spending they were going to do. Everybody was afraid that bond yields were headed back to 5%. Seems like we're moving the other direction now. What do you guys make of this and where are we headed?
Yeah, I would say in response to inflation data, broadly, the bond market is looking through it and thinking that the Feds will hike soon. For us, it's a bit premature because we are so early into the recovery and labor market data isn't that strong, despite some of the headlines going around. So it doesn't make sense to us, at least, that the Fed will bring forward a set of hikes straight away. I think one way that we're phrasing it is that we've seen the Fed talk like an adult about inflation and policy normalization, but it doesn't necessarily need to act like an adult. Over the last decade, we've seen that the Fed has generally followed through on rate cuts when the euro-dollar curve is priced in cuts. But on the flip side, the Fed doesn't follow through when the market prices in hikes. It's happy to take a step back, let financial conditions tighten without much intervention on the Fed's part. Given recent moves, I would say yields are now trading quite low relative to where they should trade based on macro data, inflation, growth, and also market inputs like euro-dollar futures and oil. But on the other hand, I think we do need to respect the flow data, because right now it is very attractive for foreign investors to buy US treasuries after hedging out FX exposure. Pension funds as well, we've seen that their funding ratio has improved significantly after the pickup in yields, and that's allowing them to lock in higher starting yields and acts as a counterbalance to some of these inflation and growth arguments on the other side. And of course, we've seen a lot of technical factors at play here on the demand and supply side. Yesterday, after the CPI data came out, we saw some curve flattening, but then we also saw that the 30-year auction was very poor, and so it led to a re-steepening of the curve. So there's a lot of supply-demand factors going on that's kind of muddying the picture. So in our view, it makes sense to focus a lot more on trade structuring if you were to bet on higher yields going forwards. I would say right now it's difficult to short treasuries outright based on some of the flow arguments, the supply-demand factors, and we'd also bucket in direct steepeners with that. What we do like is yield curve caps, which are essentially steepeners expressed as call options. It gives some cap downside with outsized upsides, particularly if the Fed remains dovish in the event of an inflation scare. And given the dynamic I just mentioned with the Fed not following through on hikes, and also with the historical precedent of the 1970s, where Stephen Roach quite elegantly wrote about how the Fed kind of chalked everything down as transitory, plus the fact that fixed income volatility is very low, it makes a lot of sense, and it's quite attractive to put these types of trades on now.
Let's move on to the commodity supercycle, a subject that I have discussed with some of your colleagues at Variant Perception. I want to credit your firm for being pretty early on this one. Before everybody else started talking about a new commodity supercycle, bull commodity supercycle, you guys were onto this a while ago. What do you see coming? How does what's happened already jibe with what you were expecting? And I guess the big question in my mind is, for a lot of these trades like copper, you know, if this is a really big secular cycle, it's just beginning, but boy, it's already moved so much. It's kind of hard to justify new longs in a market that's already moved so far. So how do you think about this from a trading perspective?
Yeah, I think you summed it up very nicely there, Eric. I think it is broadly very uncomfortable to see how quickly it's moved since Tian came on, I think it was in October, to talk about the super cycle thesis. I would say, just refreshing some of the indicators there, the argument hinged on three key areas. The first being heightened inflation risks, as we've talked about earlier, which essentially leads to this increased desire to hold real assets. The second being the commodities themselves. They were very undervalued versus their own history, and also versus other assets, particularly financial assets. So after the recent rally, they still haven't really made a dent in terms of the long-term undervaluation. And also the third factor is that there's a big investor community underweight to real assets because they've been burned for so long over the last decade holding commodities that have disappointed time and time again. And the same goes for commodity equities as well. So refreshing the thesis today, we see that the structural arguments still hold and actually have strengthened in certain areas. So you mentioned copper, and I talked about energy earlier. These guys are very, very constrained in terms of the supply side response. And that's exactly the behavior we want to see for a super cycle. Before the pandemic, a lot of these miners, copper miners in particular, but also precious metals miners like gold and silver guys, they were slashing exploration budgets and weren't really making any new discoveries. And of course, the same goes with energy companies. And now this is very much remained the case going through the pandemic, with prices much higher than they were. And it's not like these guys aren't able to bring back supply online very quickly at all. Of course, there's a massive lag from getting a new mine set up, getting a new plant, new semiconductor fab even up and running. So as demand comes back with the full reopening, really, we think that there's not going to be a sufficient supply response to meet it. And so we're likely to be in this kind of rolling scenario of persistent deficits, forcing more consolidation into the sector. And with that, it does bring the potential for explosive upside for commodities. On the demand side, it's a bit more difficult to track this. We know that there's a structural bid for electrification and digitization of economies. Copper, of course, playing a pivotal role there. Now, this is quite well known, and it's probably in the price at this point. I would just say that it is very uncomfortable just to see how hyped the super cycle theme has become, and seeing so many people chase higher prices in commodities. So we are starting to see some speculative shakeouts, a little bit of disbelief creep back in. But our hope is that we just get more headlines about the death of the super cycle, and hopefully that'll mark a nice point to then add back some more exposure. But we do need to recognize that cyclical tailwinds are starting to fade. As I mentioned earlier, that China's domestic data is weakening in spite of external inputs remaining strong. We've seen that their State Reserves Bureau is starting to release stockpile commodities back into the market. But of course, nothing moves in a straight line for a long time. So yeah, the question is very much, how do you square that circle between strengthening structural supports, weakening cyclical supports? I guess our judgment is that if the cyclical data continues to weaken, and particularly as well, if dollar indicators show that there's more legs for the counter consensus rally, then it's probably best to take profits, wait for a large shakeout, wait for more disbelief to return, and then buy back in for the next leg higher.
Let's talk about oil specifically, because needless to say, oil is an input to the price of everything almost. And it means that from an inflation standpoint, if oil prices keep going, it's going to fan the flames of inflation. We've come a long ways. We're back above the prices before the pandemic, well above. Are we topped out here? We still have quite a ways to go.
Yeah, I would say going back to the structural arguments of just incredible supply constraints, it does seem as though the direction of travel is higher. It's just that it's not going to move in a straight line. I think a lot does, of course, depend on how OPEC responds. Of course, we've seen a bit more discord rather than harmony in recent meetings. I would say that the focus should be on how the supply side, whether or not they're attracting capital back in, because if we do start to see at the margin new entrants into the market, and this is quite an important point for the capital cycle, because it is a cycle at the end of the day. It's not something that runs indefinitely. Because we've seen such fantastic returns for energy recently, that's inevitably going to lead to a little bit more capital creeping in. And then as this capital creeps in, it pushes down future returns, both for the shareholder and for the company. And then that's kind of in the seeds of that capital destruction. We then have essentially a poor environment for shareholders, where the supply side is too strong relative to demand. A lot of the lags that I was talking about earlier, those have now been brought forward, and a lot of these guys are now exploring more and doing more to just bring oil to the market at whatever cost. And I think until we see that behavior, it still makes sense to favor stronger oil prices, particularly as well, because we know that the travel season is going to be absolutely bonanza this summer. We've seen in various company transcripts that a lot of these guys are just seeing booming activity like never before. So I would say until we run through that period, until we see the supply stress start to ease, I think it does make sense to stick with the oil is going up thesis.
Let's talk about gold and precious metals, because boy, gold really looked like the rally was taking off. The bull market was, above the 200-day moving average, seemed to be taking off. Then we had that one FOMC statement that just really put a wrinkle in things. And we were struggling to get above the moving averages. And now just today, I'm looking, as we're speaking on Wednesday, at about 1830 on the gold tape. So we're recovering. Is it the beginning of another big move higher, or are we just going to consolidate here for a while?
Yeah, it's a tough one, because I think the structural arguments are all in place for gold. As we discussed earlier, the fusion of fiscal and monetary policy and the debasement of currency argument and so forth, that's a good environment for gold. However, I think it's worth going back to the 70s and remembering that gold crashed 40% during some of the high inflation episodes. And this was really when real rates turned extremely negative. And the argument, I guess, at the time was that real rates could no longer go any more negative. So until we get to that point, I think it does make sense to stick to the gold is going up argument. But just understanding that there is a sweet spot in terms of real rates being negative. You don't want them to be too negative. Of course, I think the real 10-year now is still around -1%. That's quite good for gold historically in terms of the forward returns that you see. Cyclically, there's not a lot of interesting data to show for gold. As you mentioned, I think a lot of people have kind of chased the price higher, that it's now starting to wane. We know that in August, at least, positive seasonality can kick in. I think right now, it's probably not worth adding more exposure at this point, probably wait for the seasonal flows to kick in. I would say as well that it's also worth thinking about structuring gold as an options play, thinking about risk reversals or call spreads, because we know that gold option skew is quite high at the moment. And so there are other ways to play it. I think also with gold miners as well, we know that those guys are still very capital scarce. So the supply side argument still holds there. It's just a question of waiting for perhaps more of a shakeout before adding more exposure.
Aaron, we touched on stocks earlier, but I want to come back now with the benefit of the conversation that we've had about emerging markets, about precious metals, about inflation and the dollar and all the rest. One of the things Patrick's covered in all of his chart decks is the breadth divergence in the stock market, where it seems like the FANG stocks are most of the price action that's just dragging everything else higher. It seems to me like there's a lot of signals to be concerned about in the stock market. You know, you're seeing breadth signals, you're seeing valuation signals or overvaluation signals. Yet at the same time, it seems like you do want to be in some kind of equity exposure based on the outlook that you've described for inflation. So how do we reconcile that conundrum and figure out which stocks are actually smart ones to invest in?
Yeah, I think you made a couple of great points there. I think with respect to the breadth argument, I think particularly with FANGs just dominating the price action right now, it's leading to a lot of opportunities in some of the unloved areas. Banks, for instance, have terrible breadth right now. But of course, if we take a slightly longer term view, when we see such selling exhaustion in these more cyclical areas, typically, that's a nice environment to just buy the dip. And of course, we know with banks that these guys have been allocating back their loan loss reserves. They're going to pursue more shareholder-friendly policies, buybacks, dividends, and so forth. And particularly with the credit cycle turning back up again, we think that's quite a nice environment to play for. So I'd say that's probably how we'd square it for looking at the terrible breadth arguments in the shorter term. Longer term, with respect to the inflation discussion we had, I would say that broadly we would want to be exposed to companies that just have strong pricing power and the ability to preserve margins. And typically these companies are in quite oligopolistic, quite anti-competitive industries. And broadly speaking, these are good environments for capital allocating CEOs. Because these guys, they don't need to worry so much about the threat of new entrants, about their products becoming obsolete and so forth. And they can instead focus on boosting ROEs for shareholders. But again, it's not as simple as allocating to a quality ETF, for instance. And I think stock selection is very important here again. On the one hand, we've got the antitrust environment shifting. Biden's brought in a lot of big tech critics. These guys have spoken about the very poor record of historic antitrust enforcement. But of course, there are also some risks beyond big tech. The healthcare industry is quite vulnerable right now because we've seen a lot of FTC commissioners. These guys are trying to aggressively block some of the M&A. And because we know that there's a patent cliff for healthcare companies with a lot of patents due to expire over the next couple of years, as these patents expire, new entrants come in and they just drive down drug prices. So if the big guys can't acquire new companies to acquire new patents, this could really wipe out a stream of future earnings. So quality really does need to be looked at more carefully. And understanding the quality of the management, understanding the quality of earnings becomes very, very important. And in terms of what we like within the quality basket, tobacco and food have cropped up as quite interesting to look into. Now, of course, tobacco names, these guys have been beaten up massively and they face structural ESG headwinds. So a lot of these names are capital starved. But I do think it's worth investigating there, understanding how some of these companies are allocating to heat, not burn products. But also packaged food companies, these guys have seen, of course, surging costs of feed grain prices. It's probably going to be a feature of the next year or so because we've also seen massive crop destruction in the States, extremes in weather and so forth. And typically what we see in the cycle of feed grain prices is that it actually leads to prices of chicken and beef. So this is actually quite a worrying development for inflation in the States because now we've got food inflation to worry about alongside all of the other quote unquote transitory factors. So if we are heading into this in higher inflationary regime, holding some of these guys with pricing power, the ability to preserve margins, we think that makes a lot of sense.
Aaron, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Variant Perception. Is it just an institutional advisory service? Is there anything available to the retail component of the audience? And for our institutional listeners, how do they contact you to find out more about what you're doing?
Thanks, Eric. So Variant Perception is a data-driven independent research provider. We generally cater to institutional clients where we use our leading indicators to give us the bird's eye view of what's going on. And then we pair that with bottom-up work to identify actionable investments and trades. So listeners can find us at variantperception.com to learn more about us and request a trial for our service. For our retail listeners, there is a blog that we post and updates once or twice a week. There we look at some sort of high value charts and various blog posts that we've been reading and writing about, and we put that together.
Fantastic. We look forward to getting you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade, but the high cost of buying an entire farm puts this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did an interview with FarmTogether founder and CEO Artem Milenchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview to learn why farmland investing just might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland in the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's always great to have the Variant Perception team back. You know, they always have such a really data-driven way of looking at the markets, and it seems to always line up with a lot of the views that I have. And what I found particularly fascinating, which inspired me to kind of build a chart deck around, was the gold skew and the interesting way to put on the gold trade. So I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Well, that's fascinating, Patrick, because when I was listening to Aram speaking live during the interview, I thought you were going to say sectors and breadth are something that you focus on a lot at Big Picture Trading, and I was expecting you to focus your chart deck on that. And I see as I look at the chart deck, you actually did all three. So we got sectors, breadth, and the gold option skew. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you haven't registered a free account at macrovoices.com. Don't worry, we won't spam you or try to sell you anything. What we will do is send you links to all of our cool content, like these downloads. You can sign up at macrovoices.com. Just click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, sectors, breadth, and gold option skew. Let's hit it.
All right, well, let's jump straight to the first two charts on page 2 and 3. One is the S&P 500, and the other one is the S&P 500 equal weighted. And one of the issues with a market cap weighted index like the S&P is that it's very heavily weighted to the big behemoth, very large capitalized stocks like Apple and Microsoft. And so what we can see here is the S&P 500 looks very healthy, in a proper uptrend, everything is working fine. But when you look at page 3 and look at the equal weight index of the S&P 500, there has been absolutely no progress since May on the upside of the broader market. This has really been an incredibly narrow rally. And this type of a chart really shows it. And a chart that looks very similar to that equal weight ETF is, of course, the Russell 2000, which a lot of people talk about, and where you can see the overweight into those kind of FANG style stocks is in that NASDAQ that's been running so strong. And this really continues to be an interesting thing to watch, because when you look at global developed markets, not even emerging markets on a broader scope, you see the same pattern, which is, you know, the Euro Stock 50 stopped making higher highs, the Nikkei stopped making higher highs, the emerging markets as an ETF, the EEM, stopped progressing higher. You really have the entire stock market really have gone through 3-4 months of more sideways chop, while the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, driven by these FANG stocks, continue. So that breath deterioration continues. And so when we look at page 4, we can really see this is the New York Stock Exchange, the percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving average. I like this is just because it's simple. It's like stocks that are in an uptrend will typically be trading above their 50-day averages. And so for the fact that we are down to 42% of stocks above their 50-day moving averages just shows you the deterioration of breadth. I mean, we have had a sequence of lower breath numbers since November, December. And this deterioration continues. And we're not oversold enough to really signal some sort of great buying opportunity. And so the question that continues to be on my mind, is this the canary in the coal mine? And, you know, usually you would think that if there was another substantial leg higher in this market, it should widen the breadth and have a stronger participation. And we're just not seeing any sign of that. And when I wanted to move on, and when looking at page 5, I just really wanted to show Apple, because Apple or Microsoft, they have a very similar chart, which is that they've had this extraordinary run in the last 5-6 weeks. And they have continued to be the leadership. But the thing is that you can't really basket Apple and Microsoft and Facebook and these FANG stocks with the broader technology basket. Because when you look at page 6, and we, let's say, take Cathie Wood's ARK Innovation ETF, the ARKK.
Now, Patrick, in the interest of transparency, are you an investor in ARK?
No, I'm not.
I'm not either. I just wanted to make sure that we were clear about that.
Okay. All right. So, but anyway, when looking at this ARK, the highs came in early in the year. And even though it tried to rally here in the last month, and on a percentage basis, it certainly has made a reasonable run, you know, up 20%+ in a month off that low, we're not making higher highs. And how quickly has rolled over and started selling in the last few weeks. And when you even take a global social media and you take everything from the Alibabas to Baidus to the Tencents, like the Chinese internet stocks and things like that, making lower lows. This is really a very narrow market. It's not even just being in long-term growth and technology. It's really been about being long FANG. And that really hasn't changed. And to me, at least that's making me pay attention, because, you know, it doesn't seem right to be for it to be trading this way. And I think that the stock market has a lot of hurdles ahead of it if it can't widen this breadth.
Well, Patrick, I've gone well out of my way in past episodes to acknowledge Cathie Wood for having really made a lot of money with her strategy. And I do that because I'm looking forward to telling the other side of the story when this all falls apart. I'm going to just throw in my commentary here. If you look back at post 87, everybody looked back at portfolio insurance and said, how could we possibly have ever been so stupid as to not recognize what George Soros called reflexivity, that the presence of that insurance product that was designed to protect against a market crash would actually be the cause of the market crash, and that it would exacerbate the market crash because of the need to continuously, you know, continue selling and selling and selling S&P futures into a crashing market. My prediction of the next time that the entire finance community just cannot believe how stupid we all were, most of them anyway, is when we finally figure out that passive investing and the trend toward almost all of the market being passively invested, so there is no efficient price discovery of individual issues, and all of the speculative money gets thrown in to either the FANG stocks or the ARK funds and the things that are doing sexy. Elon Musk is going to send a Tesla on a spaceship to Mars because he's going to sell you tickets to his nightclub on Mars. It's coming, trust us. Someday we're going to figure out that the whole market being obsessed with this indexing fad, which never made sense, plus the people who are not indexing just speculating wildly on these stocks that don't make any sense. That's going to be even stupider in hindsight than portfolio insurance was. That's my prediction. But so far, Cathie's made a lot more money for her investors than I have. So I acknowledge her accomplishments to date so far.
All right. Well, let's move on, because I wanted to touch on crude oil for a moment. So we were just talking about the idea that crude oil may at least pause here and backfill, and there could be a potential correction. But I wanted to just circle back to the point we were making over the last couple of weeks, which was the fact that the oil and the energy stocks themselves, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at not only just the majors, but we looked at the exploration companies, the the refiners and oil service providers, and they all have been correcting ever since the start of June. And that trend continues as there is definitely an outright distribution in this space. And this is interesting to me because we have seen usually a pretty strong correlation between energy prices in the commodity space and the energy sector stocks moving together. And the fact that the energy stocks have all rolled over a month ago, I continue to ask the question as to what is the driver, and is one leading the other? Is it simply that there's enough people nervous about the reflation trade forcing a rebalancing of how much of an overweight they have in this energy sector? I'm not sure, but it really is interesting that these energy stocks continue to be quite actively distributed off their highs in spite of oil's recent strength.
Well, Patrick, it's going to be real interesting, but I think inventory is going to be the tell. What was going on in the crude market is everybody was panicking because OPEC could not come to a deal, and everybody knows that the crunch is on. Now, what I think is interesting here is everybody's relaxing. OPEC, it looks like they're going to make a deal. Look, the crunch period really is through Labor Day, summer driving season, although Phil Verleger told us, be careful, that's actually summer home building season. So, and I think that could be extended this year. But even so, Patrick, I think what big picture is going on here is everybody is like, oh my gosh, the summer crunch that we feared in terms of inventory is going to be better because OPEC's going to make a deal. Look, if OPEC makes a deal tomorrow and they start increasing production, the lag time for that oil to get into the market and actually be delivered is not going to overcome any kind of crunch that might have occurred in August. So what happens in August is still, I think, set to happen. I don't know how bad the inventory draws are going to be. We'll see what happens, but I don't think there's any reason to think it's all over. Where I do want it to be all over, though, Patrick, is lumber futures. So let's move on to page 9, because building construction is just so busy and booming these days. But it's interesting. It seems like maybe the bubble in lumber prices has been averted, perhaps because there have been improvements in the logistics as we're coming out of the pandemic slowly. What do you make of it reversing so much?
Eric, it definitely had a supply issue, maybe driven by COVID. But what is clear is that supply issue has now been cleared, because when you look at these futures, I mean, we went from a November low of $500-$600 up to $1,800 on lumber. And that was one of the things that everyone that was crying secular inflation was pointing to, and how quickly lumber has gone from $1,800 back to $600 and just wiping out an unbelievable $1,200 off the high. And it seems like everyone stopped talking about it as an inflation risk. I don't know if I want to overread into it, but it certainly is amazing to see this parabolic rise and how rapid that mean reverting correction back to long-term average prices has happened. You know, if you go and look at even a 20-year chart of lumber, that kind of $200 to $500 range has been a long-term kind of trade range for lumber prices. This breakout to $1,800 was an extraordinary breakout out of that long-term average. And it really looks like we're coming right back to test that trade range, at least to test whether or not that $500-$600 level, what was overhead resistance, now could potentially act as support. One way or another, very oversold market. You would think that at some point it's going to even offer some sort of a reactionary bounce, but the selling just seems relentless. It's pretty amazing that this one commodity has truly, it's one of the few commodities that goes limit up or limit down on such a regular basis. Just the volatility in this commodity is extraordinary, but we're down here. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not the support kicks in the next $100.
You know, and we're down 65% by my reckoning from that high. That's really a big, big move. And I feel sorry for the guy who signed the contract on the house at the peak and paid those lumber prices built into his house price. Let's move on to one that I think most of our listeners are hoping is going to go up quite a bit more. That's gold futures. It really looked like the bull market was on again until we had that one FOMC statement that just crashed the market. What do you make of this?
Well, I don't think we need to repeat what we said in the market wrap at the beginning, which is that we're at a critical moment here around 1835, 1840, where if the bulls are going to make a trend out of this, we're going to beat this level on the upside. And it's a very critical pivot to find out. What I just really wanted to observe is that overall, the gold miners using the GDX ETF have more or less traded in line with gold, which is what we typically see and what I, let's say, for instance, would have expected the energy ETFs to be behaving similarly to oil. And nonetheless, gold and gold miners are really kind of trading in check. Gold miners haven't really turned up just yet, but showing signs of breaking out. But really, what I wanted to kind of use this simply as a reference point to talk about the gold options market, because Aaron referenced it when you asked him about how to put on gold or what his view on gold is. He immediately referenced risk reversals and spread trades that can be done on gold, and largely because of the skew. And this is something that I've spent a lot of time doing presentations on at different shows, and I just thought it was a great opportunity for us to circle back and talk about the nature of the options market on gold. And so what I wanted to just start with on page 12 is just showing a skew. And I wanted to go out something close to 6 months. In this case, we're going out to January 21st of 2022 into the first month of next year on the GLD, which is the ETF on gold. And what we're showing here is the skew that at different strike prices, what is the implied volatility being priced? For many people not familiar with the options market, they would perceive volatility to be linear in a sense of like just like a VIX level, where if you look and it says the implied volatility is 15, you would think that all strike prices have the same implied volatility. But in fact, when you go to different strike prices on options, each one has a different implied volatility based upon market conditions and supply and demand and other variables that come into play. And what's interesting about gold and the volatility skew is it's a beautiful smile or a U-shape in the skew. And to give reference to this, if you were to, let's say, overlay the skew on the S&P 500, it has a huge fat left tail and a downward sloping right side of the skew into 5% out of the money strike prices. What this implies is that it's very cheap on the S&P 500 to buy call options, and it's relatively more expensive to buy downside protection or insurance. You have to pay up additional volatility premium to buy protection on the downside. But when we turn to the gold market, and what I'm showing here is that you have a very robust volatility premium on the calls on the upside that are out of the money, just as you do on the downside on the puts. And this is where Aaron was referencing the idea of using things like debit spreads or risk reversals or collars to hedge out gold positioning, which I think is something I continue to be a very big fan of. And we even have a big picture trading a number of positions on in this manner. And so what I wanted to just do for our listeners is to just pull up on page 13, the January 2022 options chain. And I just chose $10 strike increments just so that we have less things to stare at. And I just wanted to kind of talk through a couple of these different strike prices to just show the different asymmetry that exists in this. And so as an example, if let's say one was forecasting that by the end of the year, over the next 6 months, there could be a 10% rise in gold prices. And let's say you think it's reasonable that the GLD will approach $190 on the upside within the next 6 months. Doing a, let's say, 180 to 190 bull call spread right here is just under $2. And so one could get pay out a $2 debit for up to a $10 payout, getting a 4-to-1 payoff profile on the upside. And even if you wanted to be bold and let's say bet on a 20% rise of gold by the end of the year, you could let's say do in this example a 200 by 210 bull call spread for essentially 50 cents for a $10 payoff, and even have the potential of a 20-to-1 payoff if there was an extraordinary bull run on the upside of gold. Now, it's not that these things are guaranteed to pay out, but it's incredibly cheap to put these bets on. And so anyone who's trying to hedge out the idea that have some upside on gold and don't want to outlay all the money of a big portfolio allocation, the option market is very friendly to buy upside potential on gold here.
Okay, Patrick, sanity check. Everything you said about options skews lined up with my understanding, much of which I learned from you in previous episodes. But in past episodes, when we talked about options skew, you also brought up collaring gold with options. And I noticed you didn't mention that. Is that because you don't think it's conducive to this market or what?
No, it's still actually a great trade. And there is still a very natural and favorable setup here. As an example, let's just say you take the GLD and you want to and you physically own the gold miner shares. If you wanted to insert a collar for hedging it out, and let's just say right now we're trading near 170. I'm going to do a rounding numbers, but we're near 170. Let's say you want to hedge $10 lower, but you want to sell a call to pay for that premium $20 higher. And so right now a 190 call pays you out 240, and a 160 put is just over $3. So under a dollar debit, you can have a collar in where you have almost twice as much upside as you have downside risk before the hedges kick in. It's still a really nice collaring skew for the gold market, and it's still one of my favorite ways to take overweight positions in gold. This is that if you're going to be overweight and increase concentration risk, you might as well use the options market as a tool to manage or hedge out some of that risk. And the options market in gold continues to offer so many great opportunities for that.
And of course, our pro option traders already know that, but for some of the retail audience, they don't. The solution for you is page 14, where you can sign up for Patrick's service for a free 14-day trial and get webinars and chart decks with Patrick every single day. That's on page 14 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show.
This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to an interview with Russell Napier, suggesting that we are entering a period of financial repression, and a Varian Perception article on gold lessons from the 1970s. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.